Brooklyn. Well, our guest today, Dan, is Stanley Ginsberg. Him and Norman Berg put together a book called Inside the Jewish Bakery, Recipes and Memories from the Golden Age of Jewish Bacon. Stanley, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Hey, did I hit upon you growing up and your lifestyle?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting time to grow up. I'm in my, I guess, middle to late 60s now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate enough to grow up at a time when my parents, as children of immigrants, were upwardly mobile. We lived in a Stuyver's neighborhood in Brooklyn. It was largely Jewish and Italian, and as you said, everything was local. The most important thing, I think, was that the merchants themselves were our neighbors,
right?
And they were people who felt a responsibility to their neighbors, and there's a kind of a, unfortunately, in this age of large corporations and franchise operations and such, there's a lack of that kind of connectedness.
I can
go into one of the large supermarket chains anywhere in America, and they're all pretty much going to be the same.
Right.
I may if I'm there on a regular basis, I may know somebody by first name, but there's no reason why they're not going to get transferred out. They don't have the same kinds of commitment because their livelihoods really, in a lot of ways, don't depend on those individual relationships that we had, my mother and my grandmother had when I was a kid.
Well, it's changing even now in small areas. Like, I grew up in the Bronx in the Morris Park section, not too
right.
far away from Pelham Parkway. And one of the things, we had a deli in the 90s, and... Well, actually, my mom had a place in the 70s, too. And one of the things she would always say to me was, I need to make sure this is good for the person I'm giving it to, because I'm going to see them tomorrow.
Yeah.
Or they're going to see me out while I'm shopping. So if I don't, just as a matter of pride, you do it anyway. But that's an even more important part, is that if you don't do it right, or you don't give them the right thing, or you don't take care of that customer, you're going to find out sooner than them just going away for the day. We're not in that type of area.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's interesting because Norm, my co-author,
mm-hmm.
Grew up in the Bronx.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, he's still, I guess he grew up around Jerome Avenue.
Right, right.
And, which is also another heavily Jewish neighborhood.
Right.
And he was a baker from the start. He went to vocational high school, Maritime and Trades High School in the Bronx, and ended up at age 17, getting his first baking job and baked for probably 25 years until he had to retire as a result of some health problems.
Well, one of the places that said he worked at was a place called Enrico's.
Yeah.
And and I don't know if that there was an Enrico's on Morris Park Avenue, and I don't know if that was the one.
That's, I believe there might have been two of them.
Yeah, there could be another one. Yeah.
But he worked at he definitely worked at the Enrico's in the Bronx.
Right.
In fact, I can tell you a number of people have contacted me and have contacted him and said, "Oh, Enrico's! I remember Enrico's."
Yeah.
You know. God, and apparently they're still around.
And they are, and he also worked at Yonkers Pastry, and that's where I lived in my teenage years. I lived up in Yonkers. So it's really cool. It's a great way for me to go back home, too. And when I would imagine, because you wrote Recipes and Memories from the Golden Age of Jewish Baking,
right.
It really is about the memories. It brings back a lot of memories, and it does for me, too, even though I grew up, I grew up in an Italian neighborhood, but
yeah.
We shared a lot. The Italian and Jewish neighborhoods seem to go together everywhere. We also moved up to Westchester and out of the area together. Or, if you're from Brooklyn, you moved out. Where did you go? To Staten Island?
We moved out to Long Island.
To Long Island.
I'll tell you a funny story. We had moved out. I was in sixth grade. And, we moved from an apartment close to my grandparents to a split-level suburban tract house.
Right.
And that was, it was a very big deal. And I was in sixth grade, and we moved towards the end of the school year. There was still a couple of weeks of school left. And so I walk in for the first day, I walk into my sixth grade class, And who do I see sitting there but a kid that I was in second and third grade with, an Italian kid from, you know, from PS 186 in Bensonhurst.
Where they had already moved out to that area.
Yeah, they had moved. So, yeah, Angelo. I said, Angelo, what are you doing here?
But it's true. It's amazing how we've all migrated up or out.
Yeah.
You know, when you're at certain Bronx, just made it easier to go up to Westchester, and then you sure. Now they're in Rockland and what have you. And these are families that, and even my deli in the Bronx. And it's again, I'm sharing memories just because I'm all excited. I started reading the book, and I got really excited about the memories of growing up. But you know, my deli in the Bronx, my brother has opened one up in Rockland County,
nice.
And he is actually seeing customers that we had in the 90s now in his deli there that lived in the same neighborhood that we had our place. And it's really incredible. But some of those things don't get lost. Now, the memories of a Jewish bakery, you know, I remember the one simple thing that a lot of people out of the New York area don't really get is a really good traditional bagel.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we're going to give that recipe out in the next half hour. But let's talk about what is the difference between a really good bagel from New York and out here. Is it the water? Is it the way you make it? What really makes the difference?
You know, say this. I mean, I even though I live in Southern California, I'm back in New York fairly regularly. I have kids there and I have a brother there and so I'm back to visit and various other things. And I will have to tell you, it's really very difficult even now to find a decent bagel in New York.
Really? Oh, because they're all
part of part of the reason is the introduction in the 60s of bagel making machines.
Right.
Okay. And before that, bagels were made entirely by hand. And what that did was the machines. Obviously, they could work a lot faster and they work a lot cheaper. A really, really, really good bagel roller. I mean, I have a video of this on my retail website, www.nybakers.com, on the resources tab. A really good baker can bake can roll 100 dozen bagels an hour. Okay, but average was probably 50, 60, 70 an hour.
Okay. 100 dozen?
100 dozen.
120
bagels an hour.
That's a lot.
I have a video, okay, or a link to a video on YouTube of this guy. He's down in Delaware, of this guy rolling bagels. And I clocked him. And it is incredible. The guy was rolling bagels at the rate of one every 3 seconds, 20 bagels a minute.
So that's 1,200
bagels.
1,200 bagels an hour.
So you just... And how many hours in a row does he do it? Or does he do them in 1 hour and then he moves on to baking something else?
Probably. I mean,
because that would make you nuts.
Look, obviously, it depends on how many he can sell.
Right.
You know, but I mean, the great. So again, I mean, getting back to the to the question about why are bagels more like bread donuts these days? A lot of it has to do with the machinery.
Right.
Traditional bagels used a very, very stiff dough, very low proportion of water to flour. So low, in fact, that it was impossible for the machines to handle that stiff a dough.
Okay.
And so the first thing that had to happen was they increased the amount of water and softened the dough. Second thing that had to happen was because the dough was sticky with more water, they had to start adding oil to unclog the machines. And what oil does in breads is it softens the crumb.
Huh.
Okay, it makes it much more tender because, in effect, what happens is you get oil or shortening or something, and it coats the grains of flour, and it makes it difficult, or it slows down the rate of forming gluten, that the sticky elastic stuff that forms the sheets that holds the CO2 in the steam during baking.
Right.
All right, and so the problem comes up that all of a sudden it's the tail wagging the dog, i.e. it's the machine that is determining what the product's going to be rather than the baker himself or herself.
So now you have a much different product than what originally started out to be, and now we're seeing the difference more and more.
Exactly.
Now, does the type of water come into effect? Because that's the first thing you hear about it.
People,
Or is that a misnomer?
frankly, I think it's a myth. There may be some marginal effects of the water, but it's not really going to affect anything. I think, you know, water is an easy way to say, well, we'll never be able
right.
to do it because, you know, we don't live in Brooklyn or we don't live in the Bronx mm-hmm. or whatever. But as far as I'm concerned, I make bagels in San Diego using San Diego water right out of the tap that people rave about.
And that's
frankly, are far better than anything you can buy in the local, you know, franchise bagel outlet.
Right. So it really is the process of making it. And you have a bagel recipe in the book that I definitely
yes.
want to hit on.
Yes.
Last night I served some challah bread because we do a Rosh Hashanah
right.
Dinner for some folks right
nice.
Before they go to I always call it
synagogue.
Church. Yeah, synagogue.
Yeah.
before they go. And we served challah bread. And that's something you could bake at home too, right?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, challah is really very interesting because there is no specific recipe or shape for challah.
Okay.
We have five or six challah recipes in the book. What's interesting about challah is, well, a lot of things are interesting about challah, but the one most interesting thing about challah, in my view, is that it's a kind of a bread that is not, that doesn't describe a particular type of bread as much as a function. It's bread that's been sanctified because real, properly made kosher challah has, the baker takes a little piece of dough out of the original mix and puts it in the oven and burns it to a char as a way of remembering the sacrifice in the temple in Jerusalem.
Oh.
And in fact, there's an expression in Yiddish, nemen challah, which means to take challah, which means to take this little sanctifying piece.
Right.
All right. And so, you know, almost any kind of bread could be challah because challah defines a function rather than a type of bread. So we have sweet challahs, we have sourdough challahs, we have sugar-free challahs, there's just a honey whole wheat challah.
Right.
There's all kinds of challahs and all kinds of braids.
So when you do a challah, but what separates it, let's say, from a semolina Italian bread? Is it that there's eggs in it? What are the main ingredients in a challah bread?
Again, I mean, it varies.
Could be anything.
You know, you can have a lot of eggs. We have one recipe in the book that calls for a large number of eggs and egg yolks. You can have other recipes that have a lot of sugar and a lot of oil. There's another one that we have, a honey whole wheat challah. That doesn't have very much in the way of eggs. And then there's what's called a water challah, which is also a very spare challah. And so as I said, there's really, you know, how to put it, everybody who bakes, every Jew who bakes, has his or her own favorite challah recipe, and they're all different, but they're all legitimate.
It's like Italian grandmothers and their lasagna.
Yeah, exactly.
The one of the things that you notice through Jewish cooking and through history is that food, like you just mentioned with charring the challah, everything about the food for any special event actually signifies something else.
Yeah.
Last night with Rosh Hashanah, we had the circle carrots and sweet pea pods, and we mm-hmm. had apple slices and honey before that we served.
Yes.
So everything is part of symbolism. Does that basically run through almost every food item, or there's just stuff that signifies as you go along for special holidays?
Well, no, it would signify for special holidays. I mean, the interesting thing about the kind of baking, and I think you should probably clarify that, that this tradition, this Jewish baking tradition, is really much more the Yiddish baking tradition, i.e., Eastern European Judaism, because there are other huge Jewish populations in the Middle East and the Sephardic populations through Spain and North Africa,
mm-hmm. yep.
Who have their own traditions,
right?
Which are very different. The tradition I grew up with, my grandparents were immigrants from Eastern Europe. And so what happened is over the the 1,000 or 1,200 or 1,500 years that the Jews lived in Central and Eastern Europe, basically they just adapted local foods and local food customs to the dietary laws.
Right.
And in fact, I mean, you know, going back to challah for a minute, it's really very interesting because according to a lot of the, you know, the academics, the scholars, braided challahs, which we think about now,
right,
as being exclusively Jewish, were actually loans in the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries from braided Sabbath breads of the Christians. So, you know, so I mean, everything, and the same thing. I mean, you know, a knish can be Jewish. A knish is also Polish.
Right.
Babkas are Russian and Polish and Yiddish. So, you know, all of these things that really represent an adaptation and a kind of an assimilation of local local cultures into a broader culture that are defined by the dietary laws.
Well, you see that with Eastern Mediterranean in cuisine, where you'll find the same type of thing, whether it be a baba ganoush or a hummus in these different areas, and they call it all their own, but it's definitely something that's been kind of shared around with people going around. Now, there's a lot of bakery items in here that I remember from when I was young, everything from a bear claw, and people have had bear claws before, Hungarian rolls, those type of things, and one of the things we are going to talk about in the second half hour, a couple of recipes, you're going to give out the bagels, which is really exciting. And bow ties, which, you know, once you described them to me, I remember having them at Italian bakeries, too. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited to hear about that. That's what we'll do in the second half hour.
Okay. Your guest is Stanley Ginsberg, the name of the book, Inside the Jewish Bakery. If you have a question or a comment or maybe want to just reminisce, join us at 357-1290. We'll share a couple of recipes here in just a moment. Chef Luca, we do have a person on the phone line, perhaps cool. with a culinary question or comment relative to Jewish bakeries down in New York. KBK, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Everything that Luca said in the early part of the program is true.
Well, thank you.
you got into the United States, and you got connected, and you were connected in your own neighborhood.
Right.
And your own neighborhood specialized in certain things. Now, pre-World War II, when I was a kid, born in Brooklyn, like Pat Pagano, and
like Stanley.
And yeah, okay. And the situation was that we were not Irish, but we grew up in an Irish neighborhood.
Right.
And I remember Dad as saying to me, he was a restaurateur, saying to me and to my mother when he went off to work that I had to go and at least twice a week go up to Eastern Parkway and play with the Jewish kids, because I had to get along with everybody and I had to learn something about them.
Yep.
So the Jewish culture is very familiar to me as a New Yorker. For example, if you go to New York City, there is, in fact, 7th Avenue, which is known as Garment Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look carefully, you really can't miss it. There's statues all over New York, and there's a statue of a fellow sitting at a sewing machine, yarmulke on his head, sewing away, and that was the symbol of that street and still is. The point is, where did these people eat? Now, if I went back to Brooklyn or I go to Eastern Manhattan over by the river, I can still find the symbol for kosher, and you know when you go in there what kind of bakery it is, you know what kind of meat you're going to get, et cetera, et cetera, all very delicious. The sad part of this story is there were other sections in New York, still are, that are Jewish, Eastern Parkway, parts of Coney Island, et cetera, et cetera. Where did these people on 7th Avenue eat? It came time for lunch. They went out to eat. Where did they go? They went to a very wonderful place, which was an extension of a Coney Island entity, and that was Dubrow's. And Dubrow's was steamed kitchen, cafeteria style. All the baking was done on the premises. There was Dubrow's on 7th Avenue, You knew when you walked in there it was absolutely kosher.
Right.
You knew when you went in there it was absolutely home-baked. You knew when you went in there the meat was kosher, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful time to spend for a half hour and watch these people come in off their businesses and simply enjoy that kind of a meal.
What do you think about that, Stanley?
My grandfather was in the needle trades. He was one of those guys sitting over a sewing machine. And once, when I was a kid, he took me to Dubrow's. I went into, we lived in Brooklyn.
That's awesome.
But I came in to visit him in New York with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And he took us to Dubrow's. And one of the things I remember in the cafeterias was they had this little machine that had a ticket. And you pulled the ticket out. And when you got something, on, you know, you went down the line and you'd ask for something. And they would punch the prices in the ticket. And so when you got to the end, it was a little, usually a little red or a green ticket, I guess about 4 inches long and about an inch or so wide. And you get to the end of the line to the cashier, and you give them your ticket, and they would just ring it up.
That's awesome.
You know, and I mean, this is another part of New York that's pretty much gone. There was another very similar cafeteria in Brooklyn where I live called the Famous Cafeteria on 86th Street and 20th Avenue in Bensonhurst. And, yeah, I mean, you know, Dubrow's is absolutely famous. There are also a couple of other very well-known places in the Garment District.
Now, most of these places gone now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, the interesting thing about, you know, you talk about growing up in an Italian culinary family.
Right.
The interesting thing about, and a big difference between the Jewish people, you know, Jews who were engaged in the food trades, and the Italians and some of the other nationalities, was that very few Jewish bakers, for example, encouraged their kids to become bakers.
Right.
They wanted them to go to college, you know, to become doctors, lawyers, accountants,
exactly.
Become professionals. Whereas, you know, you may have generations and generations of say Italian bakers. I know I have friends whose families have been in the baking business since their grandparents and great-grandparents immigrated.
Right.
And they were bakers in the old country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, over here, most of the bakers didn't want their kids to go into the business.
You'll find that with Italian families where they would take over the restaurant or take over the bakery when they got older. Greek
mm-hmm.
families are the same way, where you'd find them kind of following along. I think my generation's now realizing, and my two kids are nine and eight,
mm.
and the one thing I say to them is, you're not getting in the restaurant business, guys.
Yeah. It's brutal business.
As much as I love it, and I love everything I do about it, I said, you're not doing it. You're going to get a real job.
Yeah, well, this is like, you know, Norm spent these unbelievable, his normal day was 14, 16 hours starting at 10 o'clock at
right.
night.
Yeah.
And around the holidays.
Oh,
you know, around Christmas time and around the, you know, the Jewish holidays when they, you know, when they had to kick into high gear to
right.
produce, you know, hundreds of pounds of cookies and just thousands of rolls and loaves of bread, they were working 22-hour days, you know, weeks at a time. Crazy.
Absolutely crazy. I remember those days and I don't miss them at all.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, he is still madly in love with the business, you know,
right.
and he misses it.
That's the thing. When it's in your blood, when food's in your blood, and this is why we love doing this show, is because it not only brings it back to why I do what I do for a living, it just makes me realize just how much food is a part of everybody's life. And,
exactly.
You know, you can magnify that even more for my life because of what I do for a living.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you think about memories and places to go back in New York, are there any places left? Because I think of a deli, you know, which is now, I would imagine, a tourist type place. But I still remember it from going down to Soho every once in a while. There's Katz's Deli down there.
Yeah.
Are there any places that you still go back to and kind of find stuff that you like?
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, you have to look harder, especially for the bakeries. Most of the bakeries are gone now.
Right.
I was fortunate enough after I graduated, after I got out of college, I lived in New York for a lot of years, lived in Manhattan on the Upper West Side. And up there, there was a Royal Kosher Bake Shop was on West 72nd Street, and Louis Lichtman, which is absolutely the ultimate Jewish Hungarian bakery. The guy's strudels was unbelievable. It was at 86th and Amsterdam. Those places are gone, but there are still a few. There are in Williamsburg, in the Hasidic neighborhoods, there are a couple of bakeries that are pretty decent. In fact, one of them, it's very interesting. My father grew up in Williamsburg, which is right across, not surprisingly, the Williamsburg Bridge from Manhattan.
Right.
And when I was a kid, there was a bakery down the street from my grandmother, about four houses down called Kramer's. And I went to the neighborhood not too long ago doing research for the book. And in fact, the bakery is still there. It is now owned by a Hasidic family, Hungarian. And I went in and talked to the baker, and he said, "Oh yeah, well, you know, my father bought this from Kramer 51 years ago."
That's amazing.
You know, and I mean, I remember, you know, my grandma sending me down the block to pick up a dozen rolls or a loaf of rye bread or,
right,
you know, whatever. And it was just a fixture in the neighborhood, and the place is still there. You know, it's just, I mean, it's just really kind of cool. But Katz's is still around, obviously, Carnegie Deli.
Right, those types.
Stage Deli, Second Avenue Deli is still around.
Now, for people of the rest of the world, now we wanted to give away a recipe, and I know we don't have a lot of time left. For people through the rest of the country,
yes,
let's go to that staple of a bagel, and you need to do it at home, or you want to do it at home. You say you do it really well now in San Diego.
Yep.
What are some of the processes to go through? You want to give out one of those recipes?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, this is the classic New York water bagel. I mean, the important thing, there are a couple of important things in here. Let me start with the ingredients, and I'll take you through, you know, step by step, and then we can kind of talk about other things. All right, this is for a dozen 3-ounce bagels, and understand that the traditional bagel was a lot smaller than, you know, than these inflated donuts that you get now.
Right.
So these are for 3-ounce bagels, and we start with 5 cups of high gluten flour. And it's really important to get the strongest, the highest gluten flour you can. If it's bread flour, or there are a couple of mail order sources for high gluten flour, King Arthur in your neighborhood is
right.
One.
They do a great job with that.
New York Bakers, www.nybakers.com is another one. And there, you know, if you can find it online. If you can't find it in the stores, because
right.
You might be able to get it from the baker. Okay, so 5 cups of high gluten flour. 2 teaspoons of salt, 3/4 teaspoon of instant yeast. Okay, instant yeast is also called bread machine yeast, and you can buy it in the supermarkets. 1 tablespoon of malt extract or honey.
Okay.
And 1.5 cups of water.
So it's simple. It's not a lot of ingredients.
Yeah, it's very simple.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing complicated. The idea then is you just throw this all into a mixer. If you have one of those KitchenAids with a dough hook, that's ideal.
Right.
And keep it at very low speed, because this is a real stiff dough.
Okay.
And if you're not careful, if you put it at too high a speed, it'll literally burn out your machine.
Okay.
keep it at very low speed, and knead it with a dough hook for probably 10 or 12 minutes, and it'll form a very kind of firm ball.
Right.
Okay? Take it out, put it on you don't need any, the dough is so dry that you don't need any flour on your work surface. So just put it on the work surface, cover it with a damp towel, let it rest for 20 minutes or so, half an hour. Then you cut it into 3-ounce pieces, I'm sorry, and a scale helps, or if you want to eyeball it, just cut it into a dozen pieces, approximately
right.
The same size. There are 2 schools of thought to shaping bagels. The first one is you roll it into a snake about 8 inches long, and then you wrap it around your knuckles, and you put the ends together, and you roll them under your palm. That's the way the pros did it.
And it looked like it looks like a bagel.
Looks like a bagel. Looks right. Like a ring. Second way to do it, which is much easier for most people, is you roll the dough into a ball, stick your finger through it, and then just stretch it out so that it looks like a bagel.
Meaning you actually literally poke a hole on it and then just kind of stretch it into a circle.
Yeah.
You make a ball of dough, put your finger through it, And what I like to do when I do it that way is I put my two index fingers into it and then just kind of rotate them around.
Okay.
And stretch out the
that
dough.
Makes sense.
Yeah, that'd be kind of fun. And you do like you do one of them in 3 seconds.
Yeah, and it's a great. Let me tell you, it's a great thing to do with kids.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Sure.
Like making pretzels.
It's a great thing to do with kids. Now here's a really important step. Okay, once you've made your dozen bagels, put them on a baking sheet or something like that.
Them?
Cover them with plastic and stick them in the refrigerator for at least 12 hours overnight. Okay. And the reason for that is that you really have relatively little yeast, and so this gives the yeast time to develop. And it also gives the flour time to develop its flavor through all the enzymes and stuff that are in the flour. So you're going to chill those bagels for at least 12 hours. You can do it, longer. Then when you're ready to bake them, bring a big kettle of water to a boil, again, with either malt extract or honey, and it's probably a couple of, say, about 3 or 4 quarts of water and about 2 tablespoons of honey or malt extract. Okay, throw the bagels in, and then you can put them either on a piece of baking parchment or on a baking sheet. Put them in the oven at 460, 470 degrees, call it 450, 475. And bake them for about 13, 14 minutes until they're nice and brown.
That's all there is to
it. That's it. That's all there is to it.
That actually doesn't sound as hard as I would think that it would be. And again, compared to professional bakeries and the like, I don't think they'd turn out too bad even for the first try with somebody would be doing it at home. The name of the book, again, is Inside the Jewish Bakery, Recipes and Memories from the Golden Age of Jewish Baking. Norman Berg and our guest, Stanley Ginsberg, the authors of the book. It's been a pleasure, Stanley. Thanks an awful lot. We appreciate the time this morning.
You're very welcome. One last thing.
Sure. Yes, Stan.
www.insidethejewishbakery.com. Lots of information, some chapters that we had to cut out. On ingredients and equipment. Thank you so much.
It was great, and I'll put that link to your website on my Facebook too, so people can go
wonderful.
Check it out.
Thank
Very
you
good.
So much.
All right,
Thank
have
you.
A wonderful weekend. We appreciate the time and the memories. I'm sure a lot of folks